Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of Cyclocross Radio. It's the Media Pit once again with Zach and Michael. We're going to get to that in just a minute. We got a conversation, I don't know, a conversation you never want to have, but I guess we have to. It's on doping. We get into that for a while, and then we take a really long look and break down the Nome World Cup. We kind of look ahead towards World Championships, but we're going to save that until next week after Hoeger Heide. And this show is brought to you by two of our favorite sponsors. First one is Whoop, who is back. Whoop is a performance tool. It's changing the way people track their fitness. I have one on right now. It's really helped me sort of dial in my sleep, at least until today when I head back over to Europe and to Belgium and everything. And then my sleep gets screwed up for a little bit, but hopefully with the Whoop, I will get back on track. Also, it can track all my workouts and everything else. It's a great tool. I've really enjoyed it. You can get a 12 to 18 month membership, and you can get a discount off of that if you put in the discount code WAP. That's not a discount code, but a discount code, WAP, all caps. Do that at whoop.com. Check out the 3.0 strap. Also, Works is back once again. Gear up for spring racing season. With spring racing season fast approaching, now is the perfect time to gear up with Works. Whether you're riding to win or just for fun, Works has created the perfect cycling shopping page where every enthusiast can go to gear up. You know about the Hydro Shot Power Washer, but they also now have the Pegasus Multifunction Work Table, the Sidekick Portable Work Table, clamping jaw horses, all of this stuff that you can use with your with the battery that goes in one and goes in everything, the 20-volt LED portable lights. I'm going to get a couple of those because I think those would be awesome to travel for, especially when it gets dark during cyclocross races and you still want to film stuff. Use Works tools. Keep your riding fast and clean all year long. Visit yourcleanbike.com today. Enter the promo code GEARUP, all capital letters, all one word, GEARUP, G-E-A-R-U-P. You get an instant 15% off your order of Works cycling accessories. And that's at yourcleanbike.com. Finally, check out Wide Angle Podium. Hey, USA Communique, me and Lindsay just recorded a new episode. It's good. It's really good. I think you guys will dig it. So many questions about what's going on at USA Cycling. We finally have an insider there who's honest and upfront and willing to give you the real scoop, even if it's not, you know, putting USA Cycling always in the best light. She's copping to it. So, yeah, send your questions. Get on in that. Check out everything else at wideanglepodium.com. Please become a member. You become a member, you help all the shows. You help the network. You also help what's going on at cxheres.com. You help what's going on the CX Heres YouTube page. It's one holistic world. Everything I do is really coming under the Wide Angle Podium banner. So having your support makes it possible for us to continue to give this independent cycling media coverage that I think you guys like. Okay. As I say in about 10 seconds, this is episode 174 of Cyclocross Radio. Zach and Michael are waiting to get into it, so we're going to get to them right now. We are back in the media pit. I don't have to tell you what episode it is because I have no idea, but I already said it like 10 seconds before this in the intro. So that's all covered. But we are here with Zach and also with Michael. Zach, I'm just going to start with you. How's it going?
Doing well, Bill. How about yourself?
I'm just doing fine. This is like the preliminaries. We're just chit-chatting here really quickly until we can get to Michael and see what he's going to say.
Dude, he's the star of the first minute of every single episode of the Media Pit. So, all right, I'm just going to turn it over to him.
Okay. Hey, Michael, how's it going?
Bill, I'm glad you asked. Admittedly, I'm feeling a bit queasy, although I have been worse. So today I had jury duty, and at lunch break, there's this, believe it or not, this is the true story. There is a pharmacy / restaurant. So to go get lunch, I went to the Best Life Pharmacy, and I went up to the pharmacist and I was like, hey, you know, let me get a, hot sausage po' boy dress, but no mayo. And I think they might have given me some sort of special sauce. And I'm not doing too well. And I'm a little hurt.
There it is.
Okay, that's it. Sorry.
Did you for real have jury duty?
No.
Okay. I shouldn't have asked.
I do have jury duty next month, and I actually have to try to get out of it because I have a work trip. But there actually legit is a restaurant slash pharmacy across the street from the court. And with the news...
By then it might be burger time, so you never know.
Burger time is back.
Yeah.
We're excited about this, right?
Like I said, queasy. I'm feeling queasy, Bill.
It's been a busy week. It's been a very newsy week, a couple of weeks out from Worlds, hasn't it?
Yeah, I thought this was like, and you're more immersed in the road world side of things, Michael, but isn't this usually like a Tour de France road ploy, but sort of the opposite way? Aren't you supposed to like announce the doping positives before the tour starts, just to sort of drum up some attention and some intrigue for it?
I don't know. Sure. Yeah.
I don't know. That seems like it happens. But cyclocross, we do the opposite, right? Right before Worlds, and you get people who magically get cleared of doping infractions.
Yeah, I guess it gets the same amount of buzz probably though, right? And gets people talking. Are we maybe going to have more people watching Worlds now, or Hogerheide?
I don't know. Is she even going to be there? Before we even get too deep into it, Zach, are you comfortable sort of giving a 1 minute rundown of what exactly it is we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about Denise Betsema, who I think we learned it was April 5th, actually. I think that we learned, or in the beginning of April, we learned that she had tested positive for anabolic steroids at World Cup Hoegerheide, which was kind of interesting because, I mean, and maybe this is to the credit of her argument, she had one Kokcida, so you would have assumed that she would have been tested there as well. And I'm not even sure if she won at Hoegerheide, but she was given a provisional suspension by the UCI, and basically she appealed it right away.
She failed two tests.
So that was what was really unclear about the UCI's statement. Like, the one that they released was her A and B failed at Hoegerheide, but they also said that she failed a test at a Super Prestige at the end of February.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of a lot of the criticism that has come out is the UCI has been really mum on this entire thing. You know, their statement was just like, here's what, you know, we gave a 6-month suspension. It's over. It was over 4 months ago or whatever. But they didn't really explain why they found what they found.
Right. And the only information that we have is from her press conference that she gave the other day.
Right. So she was appealing it. She was provisionally suspended, and so her results were still on the UCI website, or the UCI rankings or whatever. And it was very nebulous about what was going on. At one point, I think right after, at the beginning of October, she was ranked first in the world.
Yep.
In the UCI rankings, and I know that rankled a lot of people because her results still stood. But it turns out her argument was, you know, she had a lawyer. We can talk about. I want to talk about the lawyer a little bit later, but you know, she argued that, you know, it was a supplement, and what is it? The rule is that if you didn't do it, like, was they call it force majeure? Well, yes, or if something like this happens, like there still is a suspension, but it's infinitely less severe than, you know, if you are caught, you know, purposefully.
Right.
Doping.
So there's, even though there's strict liability, there's different durations or severity of the penalty. So you're responsible for everything that goes into your body, but if you can argue away culpability, then I guess you get a shorter suspension or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and so that's what they did for her. And, you know, I mean, what's kind of, you know, another thing that came up is they retroactively dated it to when they found the positive test, which was April 5th. And so she was basically suspended for the summer.
Right.
You know, it wasn't even, you know, you're suspended for 6 months of cyclocross season. It was, you know, she ended up missing through October. She served her suspension and her team stood by her. Her, you know, they carried her as a rider throughout this whole process.
She changed teams without even being on one.
Yeah.
She was suspended as a Marlux rider and comes back as a Sauce.
Yep. Well, and they stood by her and they were super enthusiastic in terms of at least their public statements. I mean, they helped do the press conference in terms of like that she's back and she's racing on Saturday at I mean, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but Zanabeki, however you say that. So, I mean, I think if we're talking about is there interest, I think people are going to be tuning in to see how the elite women's race. Well, and Wout's going to be there. I think that there's going to be a lot of people are going to be tuning in this weekend.
Yeah, it'll really be interesting. And it's another it's you know, we talked about it, too. And Michael, I think you can maybe chime in here. But just looking at the reaction in the cycling world, I mean, there was a time not too long ago when no other cyclist would have said a word about this. And there was definitely women cyclists who raced against her who were not in support of this decision and were kind of flabbergasted by it. All of them North American, right? Nobody really, you know,
You had Nikki Brammier, yeah. You know, Katarina Nash, obviously North American, Caroline Amani, French, but North American. Yeah, those were the most vocal riders.
Farringer,
yeah. And so that's really interesting to see what that feedback has been. And, you know, even, you know, someone like Katarina Nash, who, you know, is, I believe, a riders representative with UCI, you know, she's involved, you know, she's even her taking, you know, the stance that, you know, hey, look, like there, maybe that the punishment of 6 months, like, is too lenient, you know, like you do have to be in charge of like what you take in your body. And even if it's unintentional, like there has to be some sort of, it's like a slippery slope there. And I'm like wondering, like, how do you, like, could you just be like, hey, all right, you tested positive and you have a 6 month suspension. Let's not have you serve it in April through October. Let's start your suspension during the actual season. I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe this evolved out of road racing, the season's kind of longer, but you see this has happened in the past. The UCI does this where people, their suspensions are backdated and they're often during off season and the riders are back and you can feel obviously from the other competitors that they don't think that's fair. And that's, you know, that's, I don't know. It's sending some messages that are, as I said earlier, you know, kind of making me feel a little queasy about it.
Yeah, and the thing is that also it's that the suspension is backdated, meaning that she basically accepted it right away. Like she didn't even fight this, and that's where we don't have any transparency. We don't really know what's going on. And then Zach, today we learned that Sophie De Vries, another Dutch, I think. Oh no, she's Belgian rider.
She's Belgian,
possibly using the same pharmacist.
We know she's using the same lawyer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. It's just the same lawyer, the exact same thing. Another woman, cyclist tainted. Popped for anabolic steroids and, using the same attorney, I'm assuming going to use the same argument. It just makes it a little tougher to swallow.
Well, and I think a big part of it, it seems like, is the lack of transparency from the UCI. You know, if they came out and they said, here's what happened, we determined, you know, they could redact the name of the pharmacist, but they could say, you know, they could be, we found this, we investigated this or whatever, you know, but in a lot of ways, it was just what she said about it. And, you know, I think that, you know, if we're being honest, I think people probably who raced against her were looking at, she went from nothing. I mean, we're like this woman, she's better than Sana Kant. Like, you know, like that randomly, you know, this idea that there was this 27-year-old out there who was better at cyclocross than like say Sana Kant, you know, right? Like ultimately her results were kind of on that level. It's like, I think there's a lot of skepticism and the UCI is not doing themselves any favors by being so non-transparent about it.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's like Yeah, the UCI releases a press release, and it says there will be no further comments from the UCI. It's like, why is that? Why is it a hard thing to do? To be, I mean, okay, I know it's a hard thing to be open, but it's like the idea that these governing bodies like take this position of like, you know, us against them, it never works in their favor. It like, or the tight-lipped. You know, I'm thinking of Team Sky and David Brailsford and just sort of like so much like doublespeak, and it never makes people sort of endeared or trustful. And it just like you said, well, look at these results. You look at her past results, any other results she has in the future. I mean, I feel like a lot of people are not going to be able, they're going to be kind of like, you know, like it's. Burger Time was a cool thing like last year. Like that was a really cool story. Like I remember, you know, Cyclocross Magazine did an article about it and I like shared that and I was like, I've enjoyed following this. And then she gets busted and you're like, damn, I got burnt by Burger Time. And now it's just like, I don't know where you go from here as a fan. I guess that's also another thing is like, how do we like, as people who talk about cross and like who watch it, like, how do you go from this? Like, how do you sort of watch races after this? And can you look at it in the same light, or does this change your experience?
Yeah, it's I'm just looking at her results now, and you know, before she got caught or tested positive, excuse me, she was like on this 4-race winning streak. You know, she won Usmalo, won Leuven, won Hulst, won Middelkerke, won Hoogstraat. And it's just, oh, I'm sorry, she got third there.
But I mean, her OPP was damn high.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. You know, I mean, she slipped up at Hoogerheide and got seventh. And which is kind of funny because that's where she tested positive, right?
Oh, yeah. So she was the random. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think part of the story, though, is it seems like is the fact that she was the story, you know, it was a too good to be true story, right. You know, that she was the rider who came out of nowhere. You know, if someone else had, you know, if this had happened with someone else, maybe there wouldn't be the same feelings. You know, I don't want to call out a rider, but like a rider who had been established, if then they got popped or, you know, this happened to. But, you know, it just seems like there's this feeling. It's like, I've worked my whole life for this, and here comes this woman who just hasn't raced in like since she was 18, but all of a sudden she's one of the top three people at this sport in the world. Like,
yeah,
you know, do you guys think that plays into kind of some of the reaction? I think it does.
Well, yeah, and it's also I think we are also still in the back of our heads thinking about Femke and the motor doping and the, you know, her like ripping people's, you know, legs off at Copenberg Cross where she's, you know, nose breathing and just flying up the climb seated with her little motorbike. So I think that's part of it as well. And I do think that there's just like, just no statement from the Dutch on this at all, from riders, yeah, or the federation or anything. Everybody's just going on business as usual, and that's part of it too. I mean, you have Dutch cycling, yeah, which just does not have a good track record when it comes to racing clean, even if it's predominantly on the road. You know, I went through when I was just I was actually cataloged cyclocross doping cases, and there really are not a ton of them over the time. I mean, it sort of goes to how important cyclocross actually is in the bigger scheme of cycling. You know, I mean, road cycling is always going to be king. That's where you have much more doping positives. I don't know if that necessarily speaks to if cyclocross is a cleaner sport. You know, there definitely have been those cases out there, and then we even get cases like and this is not to cast any aspersions, but you get in these weird places. For instance, Sven was on Rabobank for a decade. You know, Rabobank had one of the worst doping histories of any team out there. Levi Leipheimer, Dennis Menchoff, Rasmussen, you know, they were just dirty to the core. He was friends with the doctor who doped all of these guys, worked with him forever. And sure, you can believe him. And he says, look, I worked with this guy. I had no idea. I had no idea any of this was going on. You know, the cyclocrossers were apart from that world. And that's fine. You got Marianne Vos, who was on that team for that same time, you know, from road to cyclocross to everything. You don't want to sit there and run around with a tinfoil hat on, yet at the same time, you're like, geez, I don't know what to think anymore. And then this comes up and you're just sort of thrown into that same place. And I think for a lot of us, we used to get very upset about every doping accusation and every doping positive that came out. And I don't know. Maybe it's just covering cycling for too long, but at a certain point, you just sort of get numb to it. So I don't know, so it's been really just weird reactions. And I've talked to other people just on DMs and stuff who have been around a long time, and it's kind of that same feeling. It's like we almost have like outrage fatigue and not really sure what to do. So I don't know what to do.
And that's such a dangerous thing too, that outrage fatigue. I think that in just some of the stuff I was telling you guys earlier, like off, like about what's happening in New Orleans, I think you'd sort of this, like you can get beaten down. And so you can protest for so long and then it just keeps happening and you just give up anymore and you shrug your shoulders and you know, you just like, you kind of move on or it just keeps happening. So
yeah. And for yeah. You put it in context, you're talking not about cycling, but of like post Katrina stuff. And that's still going on, like what, like a decade later. And we're still, you guys are still dealing with a lot of the aftermath of that.
Yeah, in some literal and some actually not literal senses, but yeah, it is sort of the post Katrina environment that we're in now. Yeah, so it is interesting to look at, sort of to go back to like sort of the reactions you get from the people and the riders, like Katie Compton, you know, sort of standing by what they said and actually getting a lot of hate from, I assume, Dutch or Belgian or European yes. riders who are like,
and fans,
and fans who are like saying, hey, like it was unintentional. Like, so she's completely innocent. And it's, on one hand, I'm like, you know, there's no like, even like, I don't know, I guess what I'm, there's no contrition that's like come from Denise at all, which would maybe, even it's not honest, would seem like to be a good marketing move or like, you know, like good, it's like, hey, I'm sorry I made you all question, or I'm, you know, I'm sorry I did this to my fans, or I'm sorry that like, it's all, you know, it's really been like, oh, this thing happened to me. Just happened to me. Like I just sat there and it happened. Like it's, that's also, I think maybe one other thing that kind of rankles maybe the Americans, like we like a good apology, like, you know, well, like admit your wrongdoings, even if it wasn't your fault, admit you fucked up in some way, and like we'll want to welcome you back.
Even
well, as Bill pointed out, that it was even worse,
right? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
you pointed it out, it was your observation.
Well, yeah, she was pissed off almost that it took so long for her to get back into it. She was like, look, I've missed all this time. And I'm like, well, just the injustice of it all, that, you know, they made you only have to like sit out when no one was racing. I mean, it was the opposite of contrition. It was like she was, you know, sort of felt that she had been treated unfairly. And so, I mean, that's even, marketing or PR wise, I don't know if that's the approach you want to take. But again, for her Dutch fans and Belgian fans, that seems to be fine. That's good, because yeah. She didn't, you know, in their eyes, she didn't do anything wrong. And look, we can sit there and say that, but believe me, there's a whole contingent out there who thought the exact same thing when poor Levi Leipheimer and poor Lance Armstrong and everything else were accused of these horrible things, you know, and Tyler Hamilton and the defense funds and everything else. So, I mean, you can understand why fan bases do that, and you sort of get this irrational... I shouldn't say irrational. I don't know. We don't know. We don't know. We have no idea. I mean, that's the whole thing, and we probably never will know.
Well, so Michael, you touched on, you know, kind of the blowback I think that some of the writers are coming getting. And I guess from what I saw, at least if it came across my Twitter feed, that was always like a very Dutch sounding, you know, Dutch or Belgian sounding name that, you know, some of these writers were getting blowback from. My friend, and this is my friend is really into Road. And so we talk, you know, he can do the full litany of doping and history of it. And the point he always makes is he says, you know, in America, we treat doping as a moral failure.
Yep.
And in the Belgium and the Netherlands, they treated it as just like part of the sport. Like, and
I was going to say, we treat it in cycling as a moral failure.
Yes, yes. And so I think that's part of why her reaction was probably the way it was, is everyone's like, well, you got caught, you served your time, you're good. Like, it's part of the game. You know, for some reason, you were at this pharmacy that somehow, you know, just somehow the pharmacist happened to be mixing whatever your supplement was with steroids. I mean, that just, you know, I'm sure that happens every time I go to Walgreens, you know, that my pills have steroids in them because whoops. You know, to me, that's part of it, is like, where is she getting these supplements from? Like, yeah. What pharmacist is tainting?
Yeah.
You know, but to them, it's just like, well, that just happened. It just happened.
And why isn't there outrage? Why isn't there a lawsuit? Why isn't, you know, this guy being like, you know,
yeah,
you know,
they're like, whoops,
taken out in the streets and beaten for ruining this poor girl's career. You know, it's like, where's the responsibility on that side? But I think, Zach, you made a great point, and I part of what has always been hard being a cycling fan in the U.S. is, yes, we put that moral piece onto it, and I think it's because we race, right? That's the whole thing about cyclocross and road racing in the U.S. There's a participatory sport. We all do it, and we think that could have been us. And we look at masters racers. They're always like, they're doping, and that's why they're all winning. You know, and so we have this relation to it where it's something that's bad. Whereas you look at other professional sports, you look at the NFL, doping is just part of the game. And I think that's the way that the Europeans look at it. You know, if you're not doping, it is just reality. If you're not illegally doping in the NFL, you're not playing. And the best example of that was, and this had to be like 6 or 7 years ago, there was a defensive rookie of the year. And all of the sports writers voted, and he was the defensive rookie of the year. I got to get his name. I forget who it was. It was a lineman. And right after that vote happened, he got popped. And he, you know, had a positive drug test. And they all went back. They were like, geez, what should we do? And they all re-voted. And they still voted for him as defensive player of the year, even after that. And that is the complete difference. And then you turn on and you listen to Tony Kornheiser saying that professional cycling is the same as professional wrestling because it's all a joke, and Lance Armstrong, and it's just doping, and no one's really putting in a real thing, and it's just all fake because of all the doping. I'm like, F you, Tony. It's like every major sport is like this, you know, but for whatever reason, it's in cycling, it's treated differently. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but that's just the reality of it. But I think you that's exactly what's happening, Zach, is that just the culture behind it is completely different. It's looked at as part of the job for getting ahead and something that you do in Europe versus this morality test in the U.S. And I mean that's been going on for decades, so I don't know how you get by that.
Well, and I guess I would posit, I mean, maybe that part of why you're not seeing a reaction from the European athletes is they're all going to these pharmacists that are providing them with supplements. And I wonder if part of it's just like the knowledge that that could be them. You know,
or it may be
I just kind of wonder, you know, if that's part of it, like, hey, this could be me, so I better just kind of shut my mouth. And
it kind of reminds me of like when I'd skipped school once and my best buddy's mom's like caught us, and she's like, I'm not mad at you for skipping school, I'm mad at you for getting caught.
Yeah. exactly. Do you guys want to know the history of doping in cyclocross?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, sure.
So multi cyclocross champion tested positive for strychnine that he believed his was from a pigeon pie that was fed by his father-in-law. That would be Audrey Vanderpool, father of David and Matthew Vanderpool, and his father-in-law, of course, would be Raymond Poulidor. So that was a fun one. So he tested positive
for rat poisoning.
For yep. Which evidently was a banned substance.
Well, I guess pigeons eat rat poisoning. That's probably
That was the argument. Okay, we got a former three-time world cyclocross champion Mario Leclerc was banned for 4 years, and this was at the same time that Ben Berrettin also banned for 15 months. Leclerc was involved with the what they call the Jose Landed affair. That was the veterinarian, the famous Belgian veterinarian that was giving everybody EPO and other things. And then Berrettin got popped in April of 2006 in Essen, Germany. I don't know if that was before or after he had the blood bag tattoo of EPO on his arm.
Wow. Can I just interject that I think part of why cycling is derided by the Tony Kornheisers of the world is because just how freaking comically stupid what you're reading is. Yes. In a way, right?
Yeah.
I think that's part of why like some of the stuff in baseball blew up is because like the just how hilarious it was reading about Jose Canseco being like, yeah, I went in the locker room and I stuck a needle in the dude's ass. And like, you know. As we did it.
Or even wasn't Canseco also like teasing people for actually going into the weight room because he could get that kind of muscle mass without ever having to work out?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think like part of like that's when it like, I don't know. but yes, these excuses in cycling are just hilarious.
Here was an interesting one. Vania Rossi. Ever heard of Vania Rossi?
No.
She, Italian racer, 2010. She got second in Italian nationals. So, yeah, something we probably wouldn't be following was tested positive for Serra, which was a big thing that time of in that era. She was the girlfriend of Ricardo Rico. And here's even the better thing: her B sample came back negative.
What?
So
wow.
So she was. Something else coming here. Here is the best one that I completely had forgotten about. That happened in 2010. 2010 U23 Worlds. First and second place were won by two Polish brothers, Paul and Kasper Serspinak. Both got caught for doping, both on EPO. I think that was actually, who was in that? I can't remember. Oh, it was, interestingly, Tom Mason was one of the people upset because he would have been on the podium that year. Both those kids ended
one
up
of those,
getting...
One of them actually tried to make a comeback about 2 years ago or so.
He got hit hard. He got like 8 year and 4 year suspension.
Yeah, he was racing at the Toy Toy Cup in the Czech Republic.
Oh, interesting.
And I don't think his results were good enough to really like to make note of.
Yeah. I mean, it's sad too. I mean, one of them tried to commit suicide after this. I mean, it was just like, yeah, just.
I read about it when that happened.
Yeah.
And it sounded really sad.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they may have been taken advantage of something. I mean, not to, you know, it was a very like sad story.
I think even at that time, and it's something that, you know, our friend Adam Meyerson always hits on, is like, these kids did not figure this out on their own. You know, somebody showed them how, somebody, you know, sort of taught them how to do this. This was not just kids figuring out how to do this on their own. So that's, So I think that's part of it. You know, we get to sort of more well-known names, Lauren Zwick, Tom Mason, Bart Wellens, all sort of caught up in the Chris Merton's affair. He was the one who was involved with ozone's therapy, and also this was with the infant nutrients that they were taking intravenously. All those guys were cleared of any wrongdoing, but it definitely was an affair that went on for years, kept Sweck out of the world championships when they were in Louisville. But again, just a huge doping scandal that really didn't bear any fruit on that one. So I guess everybody was good there. And yeah, past that, you know, we just got Femke and the motor and the bike, and then Denise Spetsma, and that's really it. That's the history of doping in cyclocross.
Wow, it's not a lot.
So no, it's not a lot. It's not a lot compared to road.
Yeah, it's in that. I get, maybe that's why Spetsma's story also feels so like big and like sort of just, you know, kind of. It's taken up a lot of our like time, you know, on Slack and Twitter, is like, because yeah, we don't see it as much.
Well, and it's also, it's just one of those things. And it goes back to what Zach said. It's just because it was like, holy cow, look at just the rise of this rider. And then boom, this happens. And you're like, oh, well, okay, maybe that all makes sense. And then we're told that no, just disregard all of that. It had nothing to do with anything and was a mistake.
Yeah, well, and as someone pointed out in the article, that the interview that Corey had done, she basically was like, oh, it was easier than I thought it'd be, or yeah, something, and then like corrected herself, and
yeah,
you know, and everyone was just kind of pointing at that, and it's like,
well, there was like a lot of weight loss, and then yeah, it was really easy, yeah, and that's why it makes it so. Wow, you just want to be skeptical here, you know, like it's just hard. I mean, like, I think, like, speaking to the transparency and you know, maybe a lot of this, some of this is lost in translation, but sort of get back to that point of like, what are these supplements that people get from pharmacies, right? And like, I'm totally noob, I'm not a professional athlete, I'm just like, oh, like there's these tainted supplements, like how about you don't take supplements? So like part of me is like, I don't actually understand like what she's taking and why a pharmacist, you know, is making something for her. Like I don't understand that at all. And I totally recognize that I'm like ignorant of what pro athletes do, but it comes back to that. Like if you're a professional, like you really have to watch everything. And how does that happen unintentionally? I don't know.
Well, and I think it goes to, like, if the UCI had been more, you know, if there had been, like, here's the result of this investigation. She took X. It was tainted with Y. She obtained it for this. You know, I think if there's more transparency about that, yeah, I think it would allow, you know, there's just this vagueness. There, like you said, it's like, we don't know. It's a supplement. Well, was it a multivitamin? You know, what, you know, was it a mixture of chemicals that are right up to the line of what's allowed,
right,
to be taken without, you know, when we're talking like Chris Froome, you know, therapeutic use exemptions and stuff, like we don't know. But the cloud of secrecy and the silence, I think, just at least for us, you know, in the Anglo sphere, I guess, just creates more questions.
Yeah. Should we talk about Nome?
Can I tell? So one story, yes, one thing that did come out of this. I was doing a crossword, and this was a really, really, really freaking hard crossword, and I was just totally stuck. And there was this, one of the hints was rat prohibition, ? And you're like, well, what? And I like, legit could not solve an entire half of this crossword. Well, turns out rat prohibition, omerta.
Yeah.
Got that one clue, and I solved the rest of the puzzle. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. It happened when this news came out. And I was just like,
that,
damn. Like, it was so perfect.
That is amazing. that is really good. Wow.
Yeah. So, anyway, that was my, okay, we can move on now.
So we had the French World Cup. I guess the first notable thing that we kind of touched on last time was the absence of some of the top riders. But if we start from the women's side,
really
not but really anybody missing, right? Brand and Kant.
Yeah. Brand, Kant, right.
And I mean, Vanderpool. All the men were there. I mean, all the rest of them.
No Wout, no Vanderpool.
Oh, no Wout, yeah. Yeah.
But, like, I mean, we had two cracker races. Like, those were some really fantastic, like, I think we should start with the women, but just, I was going to say, some of the last few laps of the men's race reminded me of, like, I'm, how's the 2016 era Vanderpool and Wout? That there's a time when Wout could actually beat Vanderpool and we would see these like crazy gaps be closed. But we should start with the women.
I will just add, as a note on the men's race before we get there, and we can start with the women. I will just say that as big a proponent that I am of everybody should race for 50 minutes. This was a race that I'm glad it went for an hour, because we would have missed those last couple laps, which just made that race in the men's race. But even more than that, Zach, we talk a lot about course design and different kinds of courses out there, field versus urban versus forest, and you know, feature heavy versus grass crit, and it sometimes just, you know, or I think most of the time it's really the racers that make the race, and that's what we saw here. But what are your impressions about this no-made track?
Are we gonna get to? I mean, it was straight up Veldrigen, right?
Yeah,
this was field riding, pure and simple field riding. I don't know. It's weird. I mean, so in the green room to the green room, I had some points that I hope that we do cover.
Yeah, let's get to it.
So the first question that I wanted to pose to you guys, it's been a reoccurring theme this year that, you know, Alvarado and Wurst go out gangbusters. Sometimes Brand is there. And they drop everyone, and you know, the race, they've decided that they're gone one lap into the race. And you know, we saw a vintage, like just pure vintage, you know, aged 15 championships Katie Compton performance, where you know she made it back. And you know, Bill, you pointed out you know, you were pointing out that I think that her line choice, and we'll get to that, the way she was riding lines and just the what she, her choices is, she was picking up a second every corner. But I want to know, you know, what about this course allowed, because she hasn't been able to do this like so far this season. You know, they go and it, she doesn't come back, and we've seen that as recently as her big, you know, the Valkenburg year, she was doing that on a routine basis, you know, and she'll be the first to admit she's not like the super fastest starter. So what about the conditions, the course, what was happening at the front, you know, what contributed to, it was great. I was vintage Katie Compton. It was beautiful to watch.
I think that it was one of those days that she was finally able to put it together. Like, I mean, I think if you talk to her just from a, I'm going to get in trouble for thinking, OWP. Is that okay to say? She's got old woman power now. We're talking about old
masters,
man power a lot
masters,
of times.
Yeah.
Masters power.
Yeah. Okay.
And,
all right.
I think that it is, I think she was feeling good, and you're right in Zach, in that they were able to get away, but this was kind of a deceptive track in that it was certainly wide open, but it was still short. Right. I mean, they were turning a lot of, I guess they only did like five laps, but we've seen a lot of three lap races for these women's world cups. And it was something that she was able to, when it came into just the pure power, she was able to sort of keep them in the picture. And then it really was every time. And there really weren't features or tricky features, but there were these turns, and there were these descents and these climbs that I'd say there are four or five of them a lap. And she was able to pick up literally a half second to a full second on every one of these by staying on her bike later and keeping her momentum from the descent into the ascent.
where everybody else was either stopping or getting off their bike, she kept that momentum up and would just roll back onto them. And eventually, what we saw as well, and what we've talked about, that is happening in these women's races when they go out so fast, is that they sort of tend to now race in the same way that we typically see the men's race work out, in that you get this lull, right? You know, it's, and especially in a five lap race, it came to lap, I think it was four. It got to the long stretch. They'd been just beating each other up the whole race and they sat up, and that just allowed her to come back. And then she was on it for those last two laps. But I really think it was, she was just much smarter. You know, I mean, I think she was able to ride those sections so much better, able to conserve energy and just pick up time without having to pedal. And that's what did it for her. I know you have, you were sort of questioning later on her, line choice after that, and maybe she would have done better with staying wide.
We
and
can
not
get
gonna,
to that.
Yeah.
but I will say, like, I agree 100% with everything that you said. I think the conditions actually played into it too. And I say this, anyone, any of our Wisconsin listeners who raced at the state championships this year, it was basically like 33 degrees at state champs. And so basically frozen ground kind of melted, but not really. And so it was all about whether or not you didn't fall off your bike. And I think, like what you're saying with these lines, why she was brilliant is she was going wide and she was able to kind of carry more speed through them, while it was, you know, you look at the pictures from the morning, it was frosty. And so I think part of the ability of Alvarado, Wurst, et cetera, to like rail these, you couldn't rail these corners. It was dicey. And, yeah, you know, her technical superiority came out. But I also think it neutralized that power aspect and turned it into more of a bike handling momentum game, which she was brilliant. Pure, you know, purely, like you said, I watched, there was the one hill where she was off a descent. She took the wide line. She was riding like two or three bike lengths further up the hill than Alvarado and Wurst because they were taking everything inside. And I will say it came down though, like, I mean, ultimately though, I mean, do we want to jump ahead?
Yeah, sure.
Or?
Yeah.
Well, I got some. No, I think Katie Compton has very high course IQ, obviously, as you guys have noted. And
I like, that's a great pundit term. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. Yeah. I think let's not also not forget that, Alvarado had like two issues. She dropped her chain at the sprint, the start, and had to sort of sprint back to the front. And then she crashed and was gapped, and also she burnt some matches earlier on. And so I think that the front of the race wasn't maybe as fast as it had been in the past. I think that with what you guys brought up, and Katie's just really knew how to ride the course, made it that way. And it was so great because you had, I think it might have been the start finish shot. I love these shots where you see Wurst and Alvarado, and then here comes Katie. Da-na-na-na-na-na. KFC, you know, and you're just like, yes. I think I was watching on my couch with my girlfriend, and we both like got up off the couch and we're like, what? We have another race happening? So yeah, I mean, that's what was cool about Nome is because I'm pretty sure this was the first time I watched Katie win a European cross race back in like my noob years, just, you know, someone posted a stream and it was this course, because I remember it's the way it's so wide open and it's undulating and sort of deceptively, you know, featureless, which obviously it had features. And so it was cool that it was Nome that I had was the one where she's, you know, making this great play. And I don't know, it was I'm wondering if this is like a rewatchable. Not sure yet. I'll think I watch it again, but it might make a play for that list.
Yeah, and I think that part of what may have helped Katie as well is it just sort of like just dwindling down the players. You know, we also had the misfortune of, I'm not going to be able to pronounce her name, Marianne Norbert.
Riberol?
The French national champion, who is 21, the Experza racer, who just completely lost her rear derailleur. I mean, it was
and she was riding out of her skin.
Yeah,
she's in France, she's the French national champion. I mean, God, that was amazing. I was so bummed for her when that happened.
She was too. I mean, she was crying
at
the finish, and rightfully so.
She threw her bike into the pit, like at the mechanic, like on the ground.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've all done that. I mean, I think like I think you're bringing up Alvarado's start and when she crashed, just going bonkers. I think that that's the conditions. Like you couldn't go, you couldn't ride out of your mind, and you know, like we said, or like I said, it kind of neutralized that aspect of her game because she couldn't, because she crashed. Like you had to walk this tightrope of, you know. If you've ever ridden on conditions like that, it's just the worst. Like anyone who's ever ridden will tell you, it's terrible. Like it's not fun.
So before we go, I want to talk about Katie in the pits, but before that, even this comes down to it, it's basically a three up race. There's a lot of jockeying in the last quarter lap. Compton really doing a nice job. I mean, just coming around and even taking control, going out front, really trying to position herself for the end. Got, you know, probably I'd say half a bike length too far back, and she knew it once they made that left-hand turn for the end and was just not a factor in the sprint, but still, you know, great third place result. We come down to the sprint, and it's sort of gone back and forth now between who's the best sprinter between Brand and Wurst and Alvarado. Alvarado picks up Brussels, picks up Houlihan before that, where she looks like, okay, maybe she's turning it around, is able to sprint, where earlier in the year, definitely Lucinda Brand was getting the best of her, even Wurst was getting the best of her. And now we turn back around and Wurst gets it. And you have to think a little bit, maybe it was the, you know, I got my Dutch national champ. This doesn't mean as much, but I think this right here, this kind of we don't know who's the best when it comes to the end of the race, is really just looking forward to Worlds is going to be make it even that much more exciting, because you just have no idea when they make that final turn. You just have no idea who's going to win the race.
I think Wurst leading out from the front shows a lot. And winning from the front, I think that Alvarado needs to come into that last corner with a little bit of a gap over. I think she has to take it from the front, and she has to have a gap at this point. You know, I think that was
between Wurst and Brand. You don't really expect Alvarado to come around them.
No. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about the pits a little bit. It's easy to knock course designers. There is definitely a traditional way of setting up a course where you come into the pits and everybody is on the, well, when you're coming in, they're on the rider's left. That's normally how the pits are set up. This was a reverse pit. It caused a little havoc in a key moment when all three of the leaders came in for a bike change, when Wurst, Alvarado, and Compton all came in. I've watched this a lot. Basically, what happened is that Alvarado came in on the inside of Compton. Compton's on her left shoulder, which meant that Alvarado was blocking Compton's pit crew from the bike, which resulted in, when she was handing off the bike, the catcher had to jump in front of her, and then she had to, I'm watching it now, so he jumped in front, grabbed the bike, and then she ran around his left-hand side all the way around, and then had to go like 3 feet to the right to get her bike back. And this was a hotly discussed topic on Twitter and elsewhere. I don't know what else Here's my problem is that I met those guys. They're the cyclocross custom guys who are awesome.
They're like great guys.
Yeah,
right?
They're great guys and do wonderful work. And they actually have it up on their. If you want to see it, if you go to Cyclocross Custom on Instagram for anybody
who's listening,
he's replaying it because he felt bad about it. He's looking at it, he's like, there's nothing else I could have done. You know, I was basically stuck.
Well, if he had tried to give Compton, what if he had crashed Alvarado out?
Yeah.
I mean, because that was the alternative, right?
He had to sprint in front of Alvarado, right? Yeah.
But like if he had stood his
right. Right.
If he had stayed in his spot to try to give Compton her bike because I'm assuming Alvarado and Wurst got first pick of pit spots, you know, because this came up, this was the thing at Valkenburg.
Oh, they certainly would.
But, like, they were on their bikes.
The Dutch are in the same pit, so the Dutch would have had first pick for sure.
Yeah, they were on their bikes. So yes. Katie had to ride farther down. I mean, Like, what would have happened if he had crashed Alvarado out trying to get Compton, you know, do the exchange? Like, I'm sure, you know, he had to make a split decision.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I thought they handled it. It seemed like as well as they could. Like
that was my takeaway from it too. It looks super awkward. There's no getting around that. It definitely was something that you're like, oh, I need to take a second look at that. But
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will say it's, I watched this kind of after the fact. And so I knew a thing was happening with the pit at some point, and I kind of knew when they were going, I'm like, oh my god, this is the lap. I just knew a thing happened in the pit. Like, I could watch it developing across for, like, you know, the 10 seconds. I'm like, something crazy is gonna happen here, because just knew the way they came in, they were all together.
Yep.
Like, you know, they were clearly blocking Katie from getting to her pit crew, and it was just like this dread, like, oh my god, what's gonna happen here?
It was just kind of an interesting take on it. Anything else notable in the women's race that we want to?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I just think after this, with Wurst winning, the Wurst and Alvarado are separated by 5 points going into Hoegerheide. So it's really up to them too. I looked at the results. I think Nash is still in third, but it looks kind of impossible unless they both get DQ'd. Whether she can win the overall. So that's kind of cool to see it come down to the last race. And, you know, I don't know. I feel like that's like a testament to, like, hey, this has been kind of a good race series. Although I say that, and I forgot that my note that I put down about that was that Wurst and Alvarado did not come to the States, and yet they are the two that are fighting for the victory of the World Cup overall. So maybe I take back my first statement, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm so intrigued by, like, everybody who actually went to the States, and these two women are obviously just that much better that they can skip the first two World Cups and still be battling out for the win.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting too. You look at Alvarado; she has one win in the World
Cup.
That's
right. Oh, yeah. Wow. Well,
Tone has zero, and he's leading the men's.
Yeah, it's just a consistent consistency award. It's an OPP award.
Well, Zach, you have another metric that you've been sort of doing some work about. You have something that's even a more detailed metric than the OPP, right? I feel like. And maybe
that we're measuring. Yeah, there are a couple.
There's a consistency metric that I don't quite understand. I've, like, looked at your Google sheet, and I'm trying to, like, I'm, like, also at the same time trying to learn statistics.
Let me pull this.
And I would, okay. while you're looking that up, I'll tell you that Anne-Marie Wurst has the most wins in the World Cup. She has 3 wins. And then Lucinda Brand has 2 wins, but she's in 10th place because she has skipped 4 races, 4 of the 8. She's raced half of the 8 World Cups and is in 10th place with 2 wins, a 2nd place, and a 3rd place.
Yeah, Alvarado's just been the most consistent rider all year. And it's, as we said, she's leading every series. And the rankings things confuse me. Let's see, we're recording on a Wednesday. No, Wurst is leading that up now, apparently. So,
Well, to answer your question, I have the spreadsheet open in front of me. I mean, I think one of the ones that's really interesting is this arbitrary one I created calling the 80% rule because cyclocross, but basically it's looking at, you know, what range do 80% of your results fall between? You know, so generally speaking, where are you finishing in a cross race? And for Alvarado, she's won like 12 races this year. She's finished between first and third in 80%. Of her races, and that's a statistical metric. She's actually been on the podium in 92%. So, you know, that's, I guess, where the statistics get kind of hand wavy. You know, whereas worst is between one and roughly fifth. But, you know, that still shows that just how consistent those are. And they both have the WAP, the wide angle podium percentage, nice, of 92%. So that's WAP with two P's. You know, to stay on brand because we're on the Wide Angle Podium Network. But I mean, I think that just shows how good Alvarado has been. That's insane. Like in the competitive elite women's field, 92%.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely insane. And I think that, you know, Vanderpool breaks the curve, but like she has to be the beast. You know, you throw out Vanderpool, she's the most consistent rider. I mean, she is the most consistent rider this year. And I think we've been talking about it a lot on this podcast, and yeah, she's always been on the podium except for two races where she's got sixth place. That's the thing. Some riders will, you know, they'll do really well and then they'll get like a 15th or a 22nd, or, you know, Eli Azerby, you know, didn't finish, Namur, but Alvarado has finished on the podium except for two races, and the lowest she got was sixth.
Yeah, so yeah, that one is the bad legs day metric, which basically says, did you finish five places worse than your median finish? So basically, like, median being a stand-in for average here. So, you know, finishing five worse than you normally do, she has zero.
Wow,
zero.
Can you explain, like, that's the UCI impressive rankings to me?
Oh gosh, really, Bill?
Well, wasn't Alvarado first last week, Michael?
She was. So here's the thing. Like, okay, so
but it
if
says
you go
previous
off,
ranking was eighth.
I know. I don't understand. I saw that too. I was confused. You know, that was sort of like, you know, like Alvarado should, you know, be Euro heat check number one, and then yeah, eighth. I don't get it. I don't know. Did something?
It makes no sense.
Roll off.
They say that Sonny Kant was first last week.
Last week?
Are you at CX24 or UCI? Yeah.
No, CX24. Yeah, I wonder if UCI is different. Because I was going to say, because it's crazy, because like Magalie Rochette now is just like skyrocketed back up to fifth. Yara Kostelin from like 35th to sixth. I mean, none of this. The coolest thing here is Clara Hansinger moving up to the front row of non-World Cup races. She's eighth in the world right now.
Oh, wow.
So at Worlds, right, she'll be on the front row.
Yes.
Okay, so the UCI website, Alvarado has moved down one.
Okay.
So it says that.
Okay, so we're going to blame Cyclocross 24. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, they've done something. Clara Hansinger is eighth, though.
Yeah, I think it's just the previous that they somehow got a little wonky on.
The fun game I like to play is like who's moved the most in the top 50.
Well, if they're moving up, that's like that's the heat check. Exactly. That's the heat check of the UCI rankings.
Well,
like who's the big mover?
The big mover is Anna Kay. Yep. Seven spots to 14th. Oh,
interesting.
Well, hey, another name that was on there, I mean, had another who had a great race at home, like Mani, too. I mean, it was cool to see her. Tough to recognize her. She was wearing the multicolors of the Pactimo Colorado Proud, but what, seventh place? I mean, all things considered, not a bad result for her. And, you know, the one that we touched on, too, was Hansinger. She charged all the way up to sixth place. So, you know, good result for her as well.
Yeah, she did move up that sixth place. That's awesome.
Yeah, this is gonna be a really interesting weekend with Hoogerheide for sure. I think it's an opportunity for people to move farther up the standings for sort of shooting for that. At least looking at the Americans, really within really close shot of getting on that front row. You know, Katie Compton currently is 10th. Rebecca Farringer, who is, God, just, I don't know if kicking herself is the right term to use since it was a shoe issue that she had, but is pretty pissed off about her shoe issue. Really thought that she was, you know, top 10 looking at top 5 at Nome without that, which would have put her right up there into that front row as well. Hansinger, of course, finishing 6, having just a great result, moving her up. So I think another really good opportunity in this final World Cup. And maybe this is just, you know, at least on the women's side, we're seeing the dividends that are paying off of this whole crew that hasn't been home since nationals, you know, really putting in the time, putting in the races, and positioning themselves really well for a run at a good result at Worlds. So
I've got a question. How do they stage at Worlds? By just
UCI points.
UCI points. Okay.
Yeah.
So the World Cup, obviously, races are staged by your rankings in the World Cup.
Yep.
To like 12th or something like that? 24. Top 20?
Three rows.
Okay. Three rows. How do they dole out numbers in the World Cups?
It's by country.
Okay. So I was just trying to figure out why Wurst and Alvarado were numbered 12 and 13.
I don't know. There's no way the Belgian women are one. Defending world champ is always number one.
Gotcha.
So the federation of the defending champ is always one. And okay, they don't give out one if the defending champ isn't there.
Okay. That makes sense then. So the Belgians were the first 1 through 8 or whatever they have. And then, okay.
Yeah.
Other interesting side note, I guess it makes sense now, is that both Eli and Toon were also 12 and 13.
Yeah, because Vanderpool would have been one if he was there.
Yeah, so the Dutch are always number one.
Yeah, do you want to talk about the men's race?
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, so this was like this was kind of a renewal of September and October. You know, I think that Ellie and Tone, clearly Ellie was on better form back then, and you know, he made a point of coming in on really good form, and he accomplished his mission. He crushed it until Machu came back. But you know, it looks like, you know, Tone, things are starting to come around for him. He's getting some results. He had that really what are we calling a ding dong battle? A
ding dong battle.
Ding dong battle.
DDB.
He had a DDB against Machu at Namur in a potential rewatchable race, and so they seemed a little bit more evenly matched this time. September and October certainly went to Ellie, but man, this was a DDB.
Yeah, there was. You could, if I think the way that I would do this if I were doing some kind of like Svennis breakdown of it, I would have a graphic of a matchbox, or just a sleeve of matches in each corner, and then just taking ones away throughout the race, because it truly came down to who had the last match was going to win this one, which was awesome, because it looked like there were three times in this race we were like, oh, Tone's won it, it's over. Oh, either beats won it, it's over. And they just kept coming back.
It was insane. I was actually watching a little bit on the trainer before we got on the call, and it was like lap eight, end of, or maybe ninth lap, beginning of ninth lap, Tone has an 11-second gap on Azerbeat. And you're just like, the way this race is going, like, that's it. And then next lap is cut to 5. And then the next lap, he catches them. And just, yeah, like I said earlier, like, it reminded me of those days when Vanderpool was mortal, and you'd had these epic battles with WOW. And I think about, was Vanderpool's first Worlds where WOW had some issue in the beginning of the race, and then like just turned in like the fastest lap times. And you know, you like, if you went back and did the math, you like, if he didn't have that like mechanical, he would have beaten Vanderpool. But just like the fact that like you were so used to seeing that gap open and then the race being over. So this was another incident where me and Emily were watching on the couch, kind of laying there, and then it's like, we like kind of get up and like, holy shit, we have a race. Yeah, it was great.
I mean, I was impressed by the extent to which I think Tone went. He went all in.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the match story is, you know, he got that gap and he just decided that he, which I couldn't even figure out. I was like, he got a gap and I had to like rewind it. Like I couldn't even figure out necessarily how he got that gap. Fifth or sixth lap, maybe midway through the race. But, you know, you could just see it on his face. And I think, you know, if you were looking for a sign that Ellie was going to come back, is Tone was just dying.
That's the thing. That's what I was talking about, the matches. It's just like, oh, and you're exactly right. It was all in. It was like, oh, he just went all in. And then, but the thing was once Easterby caught him that first time, which I don't know what, you know, Michael, you probably have a better idea of what you're saying. It was like eight laps or whatever. And then went ahead and you're like, well, then it's over. You know, Easterby caught him and it's over. And then all of a sudden you turn around and you're like, oh, there, Tone's right back. He's there again. And the thing is with the injury at Namur and coming, you know, and just racing hurt and then finally taking some time off and coming back, you sort of feel like maybe he doesn't have that hour in him for Aerts. But this was a really good test. And then I think that Hoegerheide and this just weekend coming up is just going to give us that much better of a look of who is going to be able to get second at Worlds.
Well, but to your point too, this was like an hour and 7-8 minute race.
Yeah,
like they crossed
a fast course.
Yeah, so they crossed. I mean, you know, I'm sure that was like a timing thing, but yeah, they crossed it like a minute one with one lap to go. I think so, you know, maybe that was part of it too, is that, like you said, racing for bonus time actually kind of might have cost Aerts. But to your point, you know, I think back to what Easterbeat said at Trek, actually. It was like, oh, you know, he caught because Tone was ahead in that race at World Cup Waterloo, and he caught him, and he's like, well, I learned that if you catch up with someone, you're probably stronger than them, so you attack. And so he just attacked the, you know, he attacked straight through past Tone. I was actually pretty impressed that Aerts had it in him. I mean, he dug deep, and because there was a hot second where like Easterbeat was going to roll with it when he caught him, and he, to Aerts' credit, like he fought back, like he showed a lot of heart, I think, staying in that race. And even like when it happened again, he attacked. He's like, oh, I'm going to go for it. You know, before Easterbeat finally got the move. So, I mean, I don't know. It looked like he really wanted it. And I thought he showed, you know, kind of a lot of heart in how he raced. Yeah, it seems kind of interesting though. I mean, I think like we could have talked more in the elite women's race about strategy and tactics and stuff like that. I mean, do you guys have any like tactical? I don't, like, in terms of like what the difference maker was. It was, you know, Easterbeat just timed his last attack perfectly.
Yeah, and it's different than the women's race. Some of the things that made the race, some of the things that we talked about with Compton being able to make up time, didn't exist with those two because they were taking the same lines, and they were also able, there was that one little stepped section, that big up, that I think that's where Compton was able to ride. That's what you were saying, taking that outside line, able to ride about halfway up it and then get off. The men are just riding straight up it. So it's like there's no time there. I think it truly was more of a just meeting out your efforts, you know, looking at the places that they're increasing tempo. It's the attacking without really attacking, and just who's stronger. I mean, this just came down to like who's stronger. It was the type of race, you know, we have these races where, and I think we may see this next weekend with Hoegerheide, we have these tracks where it's like the racer who makes the least amount of mistakes is going to win the race. Here it really was like, you know, you couldn't really make mistakes. You know, it was just full out, like you were saying, it's just full out field racing the whole time, and whoever does that better is going to win. And it just, yeah, I just think fitness wise Easterbeat still was stronger in those last two laps, and that just gave him the ability to come around in the end and take it. I think last quarter lap, I think it was pretty much over.
Well, so another thing to Easterbeat's credit, we talked about his September. He had a September to remember, too, like Hunsinger. But, you know, I think we've seen some other riders who peaked earlier in the season, and he seems to have executed the double peak with, like, precision, right? Like, because he, like, there was that, like, he was gangbusters, and he had some really garbage results. like in December. Like it, we were like, is Easterbeat over? And he's on a roll. Like he's back, you know, I mean, at least to the extent you can be back with Vanderpool, on the front, but it seems like he's doing a really nice job getting that double peak and kind of getting what he wanted out of his season.
I think also just, you know, on a funny note, you know, he had that stomach full of anger because he didn't get Belgian Nats. You know, obviously Tone is also racing for Belgian Nats, but Tone didn't have a teammate who was in, you know, up the front that he had to block for. You know, it was sort of that extra oomph, and maybe that's what helped and it helped Eli go that 200% is what he said at the post-race interview. And I thought we actually were going to see LA get carried off the course again because he was he was pretty dead.
So that sort of goes along with the point that I will throw out there, that has Patton Oswalt just done the master job of of managing this team, the sauce boss? Has he come in here and said, okay, Lawrence Wick, you got your Belgian national championship. Ailey worked for you. It was a great team effort from all on out here on out. Ailey Easterbeat, he's our team captain. When it comes to the World Cups, when it comes to Worlds, this is who we're racing for. I mean, I could see that happening. I could see, you know, Swick saying, yep, all right, that's it. You know, my teammate helped me here. I'm all in for him for the rest of the year. Sauce Boss out there.
I mean, I saw where Sweck didn't have it. I mean, he was certainly, there was a hot second where there was a chance to renew the Easer beef, and you know, he was kind of stuck with some other dudes.
He peaked for nationals, didn't he?
It appears so, but it's weird because every year he thinks he's going to win Worlds, and so, you know, or eventually he's going to win Worlds. I just love that you did Sauce Boss. That was, I just LOL'd so hard at that. Like,
look, I mean, I think I didn't go hard enough this way. Sweek's a faker. I'm saying it. You know, he won Belgian Nationals because of his teammates. Look, he did get third. He was the best of the rest, but he's not top tier. Sorry.
It's amazing that he got third because I thought he was mailing it in. And that last lap, I was like, oh, he's right there. I thought he was like fifth, sixth, seventh, something like that. But
Wait. Can we make this like, is Lawrence Sweek elite? The new Joe Flacco? Is Joe Flacco elite?
Nice. Oh my gosh. Can we please make this a segment?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Perfect. How many people are like, do you think, Bill, do any of the listeners are just like, at this point, like, why are these guys talking more and more about other stick and ball sports?
No, I think it's good. I think we are doing a service to get these people out of their cycling only rut. And speaking of that, do we have anything else left on the agenda?
Well, can I do the Zach says something that he's impressed by?
Absolutely.
All right, sweet. I have been, I will say, throughout the season, one of the first things that I heard about one Thomas Pidcock was him after his disaster at Valkenburg Worlds, just like blowing everyone off and being like a total, like very petulant young man. I've been incredibly impressed by that dude this year. And I think even though he ended up in fifth, like he did everything in his, like he was all in on trying to get that podium in the Elite World Cup. I've just been impressed with how deep he goes. I mean, I think he has a little bit of wout in him in terms of like his ability to, even though he's not winning, to turn himself inside out and not quit. I've just been super impressed by him.
Yeah. And I think he's still like super young, right?
Yeah, but he was like, I mean, he was the man. I mean, he won Worlds as a junior. He's won U20, you know, he took that step. Like, I could see arrogance creeping in, and he's just gone, you know, or being like, you know, trying to play it off. Like, I don't know. Like, if you thought you were the man and, like, you weren't getting it, but, like, he's just, like, turning himself inside out to try to get on that bloody podium. So, yeah.
Bloody
I don't know.
Podium.
I was super impressed by how he raced. Yeah. No, I've just been impressed by him, and I, you know, because he was ahead of Swack at one point.
Yeah. And just
at least he was battling with him.
Just something to chew on for our listeners who may have questioned the selection of only three men and women for U.S. nationals. Thomas Pidcock is the elite men's team for GBR.
That's right. Yes. One rider.
One rider. And only two women. So, I don't know. I didn't see anything. Maybe I'm not following the right people, but it didn't seem like anybody was complaining. It's like they don't, the same controversies don't exist for other countries. I know we saw it like with Ireland and some other places when they didn't send anybody. And we saw it with the French a little bit. I think a couple of years ago, the French men did not send their national champion to Worlds. And that was a bit of a, mm-hmm. a bit of something, and I guess Alicia Frank this year, but that's more of the riders upset. But yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think it's because we're more invested and more in tune with what's going on that we want to have a debate about the selection. But yeah, I thought it was really interesting. Pidcock only member of the team for the elites.
The hopes of a cyclocross nation are on his shoulders.
Well, what I was going to say is that, you know, Michael, you were talking about other sports, is that one of the reasons that even though this is, again, we're over an hour at an hour 18 right now, and I'll let you finish here in a second. So we have to go watch Zion. That's, you know, we gotta catch the second half of the Pels game.
Is that a basketball player?
That would be a basketball player in your city.
Oh, okay. Now I saw it on Twitter. I know he's coming back. We have one more thing on the agenda, but yeah. Like you said, we're an hour and 18 min. I mean, let's do it. Quick picks. World champions. What do you got?
Oh, we're doing this now?
I feel like we're going to. You're leaving town, Bill. I guess we could try.
I feel like I want to call in. I think I should call in next week. We're going to do an overseas one.
Okay. All right. Okay, I love it. This will be breaking new ground for the media pit.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it's going to work exactly. We can just all record remotely again. Yeah,
you have Skype there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be fine.
We just got to figure out the time. Yeah, there's some math involved.
It's good.
Yeah, we might have to change the bat time. The bat time might need to change despite the bat channel being the same.
So our I'm not editing this out. Our best intention is for us to come back at you next week. We will have our world's predictions post Hooger Haida. So we'll have a full picture of what's going on. Until that time, Michael, what you got going on? Where can people track you down?
You can track me down at Landsoftly on Twitter, where I'm making a stink about things happening in New Orleans. And you can find me at Yeah You Ride on Instagram.
Awesome. Zach?
I'm on Twitter at The Shoe Star. And you can follow all of our cyclocross coverage at cxmagazine.com as we come to the crescendo of the season. This is the time to mosey on over there as we get to the... It's the best part of the year. It's Worlds.
Awesome. I'm at CX Airs on Twitter and Instagram. Should have some updates of some sort from Hooger Haida and also World Championships and anything else going on in Belgium, Netherlands, or Switzerland in the next couple weeks. So until then, we'll see you next time.